It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The other day, I stopped to gas up the car, and somehow a half-empty bag of Cheetos appeared on the front seat. I bought them like a robot, not thinking. I mean, talk about blowing your status as a holier-than-thou food purist. That's hard to pull off with day-glow orange fingers. Now, being a junk food pushover, though, is over, as of now. We have the tricks to snack food minus the junk, including those Cheetos. And we've a new Key 3 cook. It's Lucinda Scala Quinn, an expert on feeding hungry men and boys. And she's in the kitchen with her Key 3 recipes.
When I look back on not just what I loved when my mom cooked for us, but what is in full rotation in my house, and what also is frugal, delicious, all of those things that a home cook looks for, that's why I picked my three.
Stay with us this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, this week's Key 3 cook is Lucinda Scala Quinn, author of the aptly named Mad Hungry, Feeding Men and Boys, and now the follow-up, Mad Hungry Cravings. Now, this is a woman who feeds her four males very well, all while working under the eyes of a legendary perfectionist. Lucinda is executive director of food and entertaining at Martha Stewart Living Omni Media. And believe it or not, she still gets a kick out of walking into the kitchen. Now, this Key 3 series is where we ask the best cooks we know to share their three prime recipes, the ones they feel that everyone should try. Well, the very down-to-earth Lucinda and I got together in the kitchens of Cooks of Crocus Hill in St. Paul, Minnesota, to talk about her three key dishes. Lucinda, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me here, Lynn.
So you do this whole thing about feeding three hungry boys and a husband and home cooking. How do you pick three key dishes?
Well, being the kind of voice of the home cook, which is where my real strength is, I think it boils down to what do you use over and over again that becomes those workhorse recipes.
Uh-huh.
And when I look back on not just what I loved when my mom cooked for us, but what is in full rotation in my house and what also is frugal, delicious, all of those things that a home cook looks for,
right.
That's why I picked my three.
Okay, what are the three?
I have flat roast chicken. I have chicken broth elixir, and the two are connected. And then, of course, my mom's meatloaf, which I haven't found any improvement upon.
This is great. And what I'm thinking about what meatloaf can become.
I'm going to swoon now when I think about the meatloaf sandwich.
Where do you want to begin?
Let's start with meatloaf.
Okay, good.
Start
good.
At the beginning.
Because we can have a sandwich later.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. By the way, are you a believer of ketchup on meatloaf?
I am a believer of a ketchup mixture in meatloaf. I like a reservoir.
A reservoir?
Yep.
You mean all the juices that... Well, you'll explain.
I'll explain
okay,
as
right.
I go.
Let's go.
Okay.
So what have you got here?
So what I have is every meatloaf, what makes it sort of more frugal and the texture, is breadcrumbs.
Right.
So I have some breadcrumbs here, about a half a cup of breadcrumbs.
Half a cup of breadcrumbs.
About a third of a cup of milk, just to absorb it. And, you know, I say fresh breadcrumbs, whatever you have on hand is good. I'm going to just let this soak for a few minutes to
right.
absorb all that milk, because that's the key right there. It's all about having that moist meatloaf, which gives me a segue to my next thing, Lynn. And that is, onions and carrots are really the only thing I add, but I do something to them, which is I grate both of them. And that is because I don't love large chunks of onion in my meatloaf.
Uh-huh.
And I find that if you grate it along with carrot, it creates little bits of moisture throughout that meatloaf.
Well, you're releasing all the juices.
You're releasing the
yeah.
juices. So we want about a quarter cup. First of all, let's go back here and see how we're doing here. Oh, yeah, you can see this is
yeah,
all...
Yeah, it's soaked. It's really
this is all
moist.
Soaked up. Okay, so now what we're going to do, we can just grate a carrot. I love a good old-fashioned box grater, Lynn. I just don't tend to reach for that Cuisinart unless I really, really need it. Okay.
Okay. So,
so we've done most of our prep here, and that's another thing about this. My goal is to find how do I get the biggest amount of flavor for the least amount of ingredients. And, you know, like I always say, Picasso was a master of anatomy before he put, like, three strokes on a page.
Yes.
So we work all these years to mm-hmm. get back to simplicity. That's kind of where I am in my career right now. All right, so we have the breadcrumbs completely soaked up in milk. 2 pounds of ground chuck. Okay. I like chuck because I like fat in my meatloaf. That's where the flavor is.
I like fat in my meatloaf, too, I have to say.
That's where the flavor is.
The super lean meatloaf idea really doesn't work.
So in goes the carrots.
Okay.
1 egg. Nice binder. And then you need to make sure that you season this properly. So we need about 1/2 teaspoon of black pepper. I can just grind it right
in. Grind away.
And then a good 2 teaspoons of salt.
Okay.
That's not too much. We have no other salty ingredient in here. And I'm giving a lot of pepper. I like a good 1/2 teaspoon. It's not going to make it spicy. It's just going to give it a nice kick.
Yeah.
And then
girl
we have...
after my own heart.
And before I get my hands dirty, I'm going to show you one of my mother's other little tricks. So she would buy chili sauce in the jar.
Right.
But I like to make it because sometimes you can't find it in the store. So I just take 1/2 cup of ketchup and 1/4 cup of sweet relish. This is kind of what's in the chili sauce anyway.
I have to tell you, this is one of my great weaknesses. And when I saw you were going to use this, I was just overjoyed.
And then 1 teaspoon of either sambal oleic or sriracha or one of your favorite chili sauces. Again, we want a little bit of sweet, a little bit of savory, and then just mix this up.
There's nothing wrong with that on a burger, either.
Oh, gosh, are you kidding? And then, of course, taste as we go along, right?
May I taste? Mm. My fingers are immaculately clean.
Yeah. Just go for it. Make sure we have a little bit of spice.
Oh.
Are we good?
That's going to be fabulous with the grill this summer on anything.
Anything. All right. Now, Lynn, I'm going to take my watch off now, and I'm going to go right in with my clean hands because you can't beat your hands as one of the most underrated tools in the kitchen. We really want to get it mixed up. We have our oven preheating to 375 degrees, and ultimately this is going to cook for about 45 minutes. And one other tip that I learned from my mom, you know, when you're making meatloaf, and it comes out of the oven, especially if you've used a fatty meat.
Right.
There's a lot of liquid that lets out.
Yeah.
It's like a pool.
Yeah.
Well, my mom takes that liquid, you know, pours it off, and as it's cooling, pours it back on top of the meatloaf to kind of get soaked into the meatloaf. She never met a flavor or juice or anything.
It's called pan juices.
You know, that
pure gold.
Exactly.
Yes.
All right, so this is pretty much mixed up. And you have our pan right there.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So in goes the meatloaf.
And this is a small loaf pan.
This is a small loaf pan.
Okay.
And so mom would kind of smooth it out. And this was one of the things that was fun when I was growing up. So she would take her fingers and she makes 3 holes. 1, 2, 3. And those little holes, that's what I mean by a reservoir. And into the reservoir goes the chili sauce. And when we were growing up, my brothers and I, we would sort of argue a little bit about who got more. And no matter what happened, the way it's cut up, everybody gets a little bit.
I love this idea. So from what I understand through the magic of radio, a cooked one of your mother's meatloaf is going to appear momentarily.
Don't you see me drooling? I've been smelling it as
well,
we've been cooking.
I'll have to tell you.
I'm just going to grab this to pull it out of the oven. Thank
right.
you. Oh,
brother.
There we go. You know how smell is just like one of our greatest senses? I smell this meatloaf, and I am instantly sitting at my mother's dinner table.
You want to do the honors?
Sure, let me see. All right. I got to make sure, Lynn, that you get some of the reservoir of chili sauce.
I have to have some reservoir of chili sauce. Oh, yeah.
There you
go.
Yeah.
It's literally a river of dark red right down the center of the meatloaf. I love the orange of the carrots, too.
Yeah.
And I've got some of that river right here.
Yeah, so you can just dip back and forth. Please,
you know,
go for it.
And go
no,
first.
You eat first.
Oh, wow. You know what's great? That grating gives you a different kind of melding. I get a little carrot. I get a little onion.
Yeah, it's not chunky because some people, like, especially with kids, they'll be like, I hate onions. Or I don't
they'll
like
never
the
know
vegetable.
They're there.
They'll never know, and it just seamlessly kind of falls over the tongue with the rest of the meat.
This is one of the most outstanding meatloaves I've ever eaten.
Oh, my gosh.
And what I'm going to do is go home and make it tonight, but I'm not going to let my husband know that it's there.
I'm going to call my mom and tell her that you said that.
Okay, good.
Good
hey,
deal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. I'm happy to be with you.
It was a pleasure.
Lucinda Scala Quinn is author of Mad Hungry Cravings. Listen to the rest of our Key 3 conversation, check out the photos that we snapped, and find those 3 recipes, old school meatloaf, flat roasted chicken, and chicken broth elixir. All of it is on the website, splendidtable.org. Imagine building a career around roaming America, the back roads and obscure neighborhoods. You have one goal: find the best local food joints. Never will a chain burger cross your lips. Well, this is Jane and Michael Stern's Road Food, their website and their life's work. Hey, you two, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Hi, Lynn.
You know, you talk about sleeves-up cuisine, meaning, you know, the places that are really casual. Do you have, like, the best of the ultra-informal places to eat?
Ultra-informal. How about a place that brings you your food on a shovel and dumps it on your table?
Is it a clean shovel?
It is a clean shovel. This is Bowen's Oyster Roast outside of Charleston, South Carolina. And there are a few other things on the menu, but basically you go there, you pay one price, and they will keep bringing just roasted oysters to the table on a shovel and dumping it on the table as long as you want to eat them.
Isn't that the place where they're roasting them like on a sheet of metal?
Yes.
Yes.
Over a fire?
Yes.
And
exactly.
It feels like you're in a bunker from World War II?
Yes.
It's all cement.
And the shells of oysters outside that are, you know, up to an
elephant's
eye.
Piles. The Mount Everests of oyster shells are outside. It's fabulous. And you go down this long dirt road.
Absolutely.
You would never know you were going to any place that, you know, was open to the public.
And the thing, what's great is there are very few amenities. If you want, for example, melted butter to dip your oyster in once you open it up, I don't. The oyster is fine as it is with me. But if you want melted butter, bring your own stick. They will melt it for you.
I've heard of BYOB.
Right.
Now it has a new
meaning.
Okay, so that's one great super casual, to put it mildly. What's another one?
Michael, what's Fuel City in Dallas?
Fuel.
I see you wrote that down here, and I don't remember.
No,
Fuel City
in Dallas, as you might suspect, is a gas station, but not just a gas station.
Oh, yes, Fuel City. Okay, it's all
It's a gas down. Station. It is the finest car wash in all of Dallas. In back is a herd of Longhorn cattle, and it is open 24/7. And inside is the largest selection of beer in all of Texas. But along with all that stuff, there is a window that you walk up to, and 24 hours a day, you can buy tacos. And these tacos, they're less than a dollar a piece. Maybe you want maybe 4 to 6 for a meal. And they are spectacularly good. Barbacoa, chicken tacos. There are actually meatless tacos if you want. And, you know, they're topped with a little fresh lime juice, cilantro. I mean, they're the kind of taco that in a finer urban restaurant, you might pay $6 to $10 for it. These are less than a buck a piece.
And Pico de Gallo is just, which is the chopped up relish and cilantro.
Yes.
And
oh,
onion.
Yeah, with the tomato and the onion
and
the
chilies. Lime.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
All right, so we've got a shovel and we have a gas station. These are pretty informal. One more?
Track Kitchen.
Yeah, the Track Kitchen in Aiken, South Carolina. Now, Aiken is an interesting town because it's sort of where all the horsey people go, and people exercise their thoroughbreds, and people fox hunt from there. So we were down there for the horses, but there's a place next to the exercise track called the Track Kitchen. It is so informal that the first time we went there, we walked in, we were sitting at these kind of long communal mess hall type tables. People come and go. Everyone who eats there knows everybody else. We were chatting with them. We were chatting with Carol Carter and Pockets, who run the place. And it was a wonderful breakfast that we had there. It was like grits and country ham and biscuits and all of that stuff. And we walked out happy as can be. And only 15 minutes later did we realize we had forgotten to pay. Because it's that kind of place. People pay weekly, monthly, or sometimes by the day. It's that casual.
And that's where the mink and manure set eats.
That's exactly the right term for it. Yes.
The equestrian community.
Yeah, thank you. I like that better. That's very classy. Hey, thank you both.
Okay,
you're welcome, Lynn. Bye.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of RoadFood.com. Now, you can track their latest finds on our website, splendidtable.org. Now, while you're there, check out all the other splendid table opportunities. Our weekly podcasts, our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, browse our recipe box, and take a look at our e-books and our summertime griller's guide. It's all at, you know where, splendidtable.org. Coming up, DIY junk food, in other words, junk food without the junk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. If you're one of those people who reads the ingredient list on the back of the bag of Cheetos but buys them anyway, well, this one's for you. Laura Ferroni is coming to the rescue. She's managed to recreate, some would say re-engineer, some of the world's most beloved snacks. Think Twinkies, Ding Dongs, and Cheez-Its, without all that bad stuff. She's the author of Real Snacks, and our correspondent, WAMU's Rebecca Shear, gets the story.
Twinkies, cheese puffs, corn nuts, potato chips. These popular snacks aren't necessarily what we would think of as healthy, right? But in her new book, Real Snacks, Make Your Favorite Childhood Treats Without All the Junk, Laura Ferroni presents recipes for a bunch of sweet and salty goodies without, yes, the junk. You know, artificial colorings and flavorings, refined sugars, preservatives. She even offers vegan and gluten-free versions of everything from moon pies to mini donuts and corn chips to crescent rolls. Laura, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So tell me, Laura, what was your inspiration for writing this book?
Well, I have a sort of a fascination with things that we think as a culture that we can't make at home anymore. So crackers and cookies and sort of snack cake kind of things that we kind of all grew up with but sort of feel like we can't make in the home. So I got interested in figuring out how to do that so that we didn't have to have all of the processed stuff in our food.
But just to clarify now, the recipes in the book aren't necessarily low-fat or low-calorie?
No, they're really not. They are, you know, intended to be treats, and they're not low-calorie, but they do have higher nutrients and less of the artificial colors and things like that.
So how did you go about creating and testing these recipes?
Well, I started with just playing with some different flours that you might not normally use, things like millet flour or sorghum flour, just to create some different textures and flavors. But really it was just sort of taking a look at all of the ingredients that were in the processed food and figuring out, you know, what is that actual processed ingredient doing in the recipe? So if it's less than, you know, that's an emulsifier, do you have some way of replicating that with things you would just already have in your pantry?
What are some of the snacks where you think the junk-free version will really surprise people, either in terms of how easy it is to make or how much it, like, bears an uncanny resemblance taste-wise to its original processed version?
You know what? Probably the easiest one to make and to make it to taste the most like the store-bought version are Fritos, because there's really not too much to them other than the getting a good corn flour to begin with. You want to use a good masa. If you look at the ingredients on Fritos, it's not that crazy. They're pretty much just corn and corn flour and salt and some oil. So making that at home is quite simple. The one that I think was most surprising when I give them to people are the Doritos. Particularly when I make the vegan version, nobody knows that they're vegan.
Really?
You don't really miss the cheese because you have all the other really great spices. And, you know, when people try those, their eyes kind of light up going, that's a Dorito, and there's not even any cheese in it.
What about the Cheetos, or as you call them, crunchy cheese puffs? They seem to be especially involved. I mean, you make the dough, you steam the dough, you dry the dough, then I think you fry the dough.
Yes, they are definitely involved. I started making Cheetos with a much less arduous process. Way to get those to really puff and actually resemble the real thing is rather challenging. I started with a dough that was a corn-based and cheese dough that you fry, but they just didn't have the right puff to be Cheetos. And then I was snacking on some shrimp chips that are sort of the Asian equivalent, and realized that hey, this is more the texture that I was looking for. So then I started researching recipes for how to make your own shrimp chips and then applied that same process to Cheetos. So using the tapioca flour, which really changes in texture when you steam it and then you dry it and then you fry it, it actually gets that puff that otherwise it's really hard to do without, you know, roomfuls of industrial equipment.
I'm curious if there's one snack, either sweet or salty, that you tried making and you just couldn't do it. I don't want to call it a failure, but you couldn't do it.
Yeah, there were a few that I just didn't feel were quite good enough. And the main one would be Pringles. I did come up with a recipe that tasted a lot like a Pringle. Can never get the fun duckbill shape. And it was a lot of work for a very small number of chips. So it just ended up not quite making the grade. You know, the Cheetos certainly were a lot of work, but you at least end up with a lot of Cheetos at the end. And the Pringles were a lot of work, and then you ended up with 6 Pringles.
Well, Laura Ferroni, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you very much.
Laura Ferroni is author of Real Snacks, Make Your Favorite Childhood Treats Without All the Junk. Rebecca Shear is the host of Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5 in Washington, D.C. Lara left us with recipes for the legendary crunchy cheese puffs, a tad of a project, this one, and the simpler corn chip strips. You're going to find them on the website, splendidtable.org. Tex-Mex gets a bad rap from certain self-described purists. It's blamed for all the lousy Mexican fast food chains. People say that it's just bastardized northern Mexico food with too much of everything, from sour cream and cheese to chilies and tomatoes. And that's sort of where food writer and Clarkson Potter editor Francis Lamb stood for years. But one of his buddies is Texas Food Authority Rob Walsh. Now, this man writes, walks, talks, and eats Texas. So Rob sent Francis to an Austin place called Amaya's Taco Village. Well, Amaya's turned around Francis's thinking, so much so that he tracked down Rob Walsh to talk Tex-Mex with a more open mind.
Great to have you today, Rob.
Hey, good to be here.
So, Rob, the question for you today is Tex-Mex a legit American regional cuisine?
Well, of course it is, but it's kind of complicated. I mean, the regional cuisine that is now called Tex-Mex has been here in Texas for a long time. I mean, dating all the way back to the Spanish missions, really. But we always called it Mexican food. The line in the sand was drawn by Diana Kennedy in her book Cuisines of Mexico when she said that so-called Mexican food north of the border isn't really Mexican food. And so everybody suddenly had to reconsider what Mexican food really was. But eventually, you know, you have to admit, okay, if Mexicans want to distinguish between their cuisine, their culture, and that cuisine north of the border, then we have to accept that Tex-Mex, which is what we've come to call Mexican cuisine in Texas, isn't really Mexican food. So the next bit of logic is, well, if it isn't really Mexican food, what is Tex-Mex? And the answer has to be an American regional cuisine. And I'm very comfortable with that. You know, I'm proud of it.
Mm. But I think for a lot of people, and to be completely frank, myself included for a long time, I thought when you walk into any old, you know, Joe Schmo Mexican restaurant and you see under enchiladas or see under tacos, choice of beef, chicken, or cheese, that means you're not eating, quote-unquote, real Mexican food, and that means you're looking at Tex-Mex. But can you tell me what really are the important dishes of Tex-Mex cooking?
Well, let me turn the tables on you for a second. Have you spent much time in Mexico?
I haven't.
You know, when you get to Mexico, you start looking for this real Mexican cuisine that everybody's talking about, and you know, you find Nescafe coffee for breakfast and Bimbo sweet rolls instead of the egg tacos you're used to, and you realize that what we call authentic Mexican food is really a couple of cherry-picked dishes from some great cuisines that are spread all over the country. Tex-Mex is a Texas version of Mexican food, And it's a commercial cuisine for the most part. It mostly exists in restaurants, but it was kind of adapted from Tejano home cooking. The Spanish pulled out of Texas in the late 1700s and left behind Spanish-speaking Mission Indians who became known as the Tejanos. They came from Native American stock, and they were really not Mexicans. They had never lived in Mexico. They had been acculturated by the Spanish missionaries here in Texas. And Tex-Mex cuisine is descended from their tradition and also from a lot of Canary Islanders who were brought to San Antonio by the Spanish to try and expand the colonization of Texas. And the Canary Islanders brought with them a Berber flavor signature, you know, Moroccan food. There was a lot of cumin, there was a lot of garlic, a lot of chili. And those flavors, which are really dominant in chili con carne, became the flavor signature of Tex-Mex. It's very different from Mexican food. Diana Kennedy is prone to say that, you know, Tex-Mex includes way too much cumin. But if you compare it to Arab food, you suddenly understand where that flavor signature comes from.
Mm. So aside from chile con carne, what are other dishes that we might see that kind of influence? Like, what are the other dishes of Tex-Mex cuisine?
Well, you know, to stick with chile con carne for just a second, Raul Molina Jr., a Tex-Mex entrepreneur who grew up in the apartment above his family's restaurant where his mom was the cook, his father was the waiter, and he was the busboy, told me that in the early days of Tex-Mex, it was basically just short-order cooking plus chili con carne. He said people came in, his mom had a big pot of chili con carne, she'd make scrambled eggs with chili, she'd make steak with chili, she'd make a hamburger with chili, she'd make just about anything and add chili, and that became Tex-Mex. And Raul Molina's told me that, you know, after Glenn Bell invented Taco Bell out in San Bernardino, California, and started to come across the country with his preformed taco shells, that was when Tex-Mex restaurants first tried making preformed taco shells. So I blame the sort of fast food influence on Tex-Mex entirely on California.
So yeah, my first experience with great Tex-Mex food was a recommendation of yours when you told me to go to Amaya's Taco Village in Austin. Uh-huh. And I was blown away by the fajita tacos and how the tortillas were clearly freshly made, but mm-hmm. also a little bit fried. And I know there's this thing called puffy tacos. Can you tell me about these different variations on tacos?
Well, back in the days before the preformed taco shell, tacos were always fried to order. And a puffy taco is when you take a fresh masa tortilla, one that hasn't been cooked yet. When you buy a package of tortillas in the supermarket, they're masa discs which have been cooked. A fresh masa tortilla which hasn't been cooked yet, when dropped into a deep fryer, will puff up. And if you hold it in a taco, a U-shaped holder, it makes what you call a puffy taco shell. These are absolutely delicious. They're crispy on the outside, kind of soft in the middle. They're just fabulous. A variation that was especially famous in Austin was called the crispy taco. It was slightly cooked and then deep fried, so it had a crispy outside, a soft interior. It didn't puff up quite as much. Mm. And that's the tradition which Amaya's Taco Village continues.
All right, well, I need to get back down there. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Rob.
Well, thanks for calling, Francis.
Rob Walch is author of The Hot Sauce Cookbook. Francis Lamb is an editor for Clarkson Potter. Find Rob's recipe for Mexican shrimp cocktail on the website, splendidtable.org. You never call my name. Well, it is time for you to talk to me. I'm game to take on just about anything. Call us, 800-537-5252. And remember, you can always connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. So let's see. Brendan's on the line from Ames, Iowa. Brendan, what do you want to talk about today?
Hello, Lynn. I want to talk about magic beans.
Do you have a beanstalk outside the door?
I do, but it doesn't produce beans like the ones that my sister-in-law brought back from Spain.
What kind of beans?
I have no idea. They were ginormous white beans, and they came in a cool bag.
Yeah.
But I don't know where to find them now.
Do they have a name?
The top of the bag says Judias de El Barco de Evia.
The Judias is J-U-D-I-A-S?
Correct.
That means Jewish, which
okay.
is interesting. Say it again to me.
Judias
yeah.
de El Barco de Evia.
Okay.
A-V-I-L-A. I think that's their place of origin.
Right. Now, you haven't run into these beans specifically, but when I was in Spain, I saw quite a few beans like that. And I think these are protected by domain of origin rules, you know, their laws or regulations, where these are foods that are traditionally from this place. And now, when they're properly grown in that place, they can be labeled as such.
Sure.
And so describe what they're big and white. What's the shape? Are they sort of long or are
they
rounder?
They were dry beans, so
right.
they were big and they're kind of kidney bean shaped, like a big butter bean or a lima bean.
Okay.
And they're, you know, but they're about half an inch around.
And how did they taste?
They were delicious. They were, you know, when you cooked them, they got very creamy.
Yeah, I know what you have. You have one of the many forms of maybe my all-time favorite bean. In Italy, they're called Great Spanish Whites or Coronas. And I think they pop up all over the Mediterranean. I think they're the Soissons of France. And they're creamy. They don't taste, in quotes, bean-like, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're very clean.
Oh, they're just delicious. These, okay, the way you would find them here is one of the names for them is Corona. And it's just, I think, C-O-R-O-N-A.
Okay.
And you can mail order them. Like, for instance, I know Chef Shop, which is based in Seattle. ChefShop.com has them. And they're not an inexpensive site, but they're a pretty dependable site in terms of, you know, the quality of what they sell.
Sure.
So, but it's Corona beans that you want. And they're also being grown domestically. I'm not sure if the place I'm telling you now might have them, but they do specialize in heirloom beans. It's Rancho Gordo.
Rancho Gordo. That would be interesting to be able to plant them yourself.
Yeah, well, they sell beans. I mean, they raise beans. They raise heirloom beans, and they may have them. They look like oversized. They look like lima beans on steroids, and they're white, and they're just beautiful to look at. But that's what you're looking for when you look at pictures. So I would check out Chef Shop. I'd check out foodsfromspain.com. I'd check out La Tienda. .com. I'd check out Rancho Gordo, which specializes in beans. And you know, the other place I would check out is Seed Savers, because they not
sure.
only have seeds, but they also have heirloom beans, and they just might have them.
That will be easy.
Yeah, what's great about Seed Savers is that, you know, it's a nonprofit and it supports biodiversity. They have one of the great seed banks in the world. But any of those sources, and I agree with you, I think they're the dream bean, the magic bean.
They are. They are magical. One big pot a year would do you, but...
Yeah, but hey, it wouldn't hurt to have a pound in the, you know, hanging around, and whenever you want some, they're there.
Exactly.
Hey, thank you, Brendan. Thanks for bringing back a good memory, too.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye.
These beans are so delicious, and for summer salads... You cook them up. I cook them up with sage and garlic, and then you just let them cool, and you dress them with a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of vinegar, and then, you know, fresh herbs, and some red onion. It's a classic from Tuscany, and it's just fabulous. So, 800-537-5252. That's how you can connect with us. Also on Facebook and Twitter. We're going to be back with your questions. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM. American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Back to your calls. Anything goes. Call me, 800-537-5252. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. You can shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Sue Ann is on the line from Nashville. Sue Ann, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about some great menu ideas for my 21st birthday party.
You're going to do your birthday party yourself?
Yes, actually, I'm having it at my house. It's starting a little bit later in the evening, so, you know, not main dishes, just party
food. Just party food, things that people can mm-hmm. snack and grab and that kind of thing.
Yes.
Okay, let's see. All right, first of all, I realize everybody does this, but I have got a dip for you. No, because the idea of having the whole point of parties is let the guests do the work rather than you spending, you know, hours in the kitchen making funny little things that people pick up with their fingers. Let them pick up with their fingers, but you mix up some really interesting sauces and then they can just take chips of vegetables and go for it. And mm-hmm. one of the combinations, this is something that we've got a new ebook quarterly out on summer parties, and this is really a dynamite dip to do. What you do is you toast some almonds, okay? You take some good tasting paprika. It can be smoky Spanish paprika, or it could just be a good tasting, you know, sweet paprika. Some garlic, some olive oil, and some chopped onion, and some tomato paste. So like a big tablespoon of tomato paste, about 3 or 4 tablespoons of olive oil, a couple of cloves of garlic, really thin sliced, and half an onion minced. And then you mix that all together in a microwave-proof dish, and you cover it, and you put it in the microwave for about 2 minutes. And then you mix that with good-tasting plain yogurt and some sour cream. And add a good shot of lemon, and taste it for salt and pepper. You can do anything with that. I mean, you can dunk shrimp in that. You can dunk zucchini in that. And it's really fabulous. You could also use it as a sauce.
Right.
Are a lot of people in the group vegetarians?
A few.
But not
a majority, yeah.
Because you're in great pork country. No, and what I'm thinking is this, is to take a pork tenderloin, marinate it however you want. I mean, one great way is to do orange juice and orange rind. And if you want a bit of chili or ancho chili powder and a little oil and garlic and let that sit overnight. And then you do this whenever you want. You could do this a day ahead. You slow roast it in the oven until the internal temperature is about 150 degrees. Let that really cool down. You could even chill it. But what you want to do is slice it into small bits where you can stick a toothpick in it. Mm-hmm. And people can just go for it. Or you have little biscuits or rolls and you've sliced it into tiny pieces so that people can just slip that onto a small biscuit. Nothing bigger than a mouthful.
That sounds perfect.
Yeah. And then, by the way, some of the sauce I mentioned to you on mm-hmm. that, not a bad thing at all. Then you want to have, you know, baskets and baskets of veggies they can eat with their fingers. Radishes with a pot of soft butter on the side and some coarse salt so that people can just, you know, run through the butter and run through the radish. Make sure they're small enough that you can just do them in one bite. Cherry tomatoes are fabulous.
I just got some in my CSA.
Well, you see, there you go. Whatever looks good in the market that you can eat raw. So that could be asparagus, carrots, zucchini, cucumbers. You know, even baby turnips are delicious raw. And if you want to, you can marinate them with vinegar and a bit of sugar and the spices you like best. Like I like to do cinnamon and garlic and black pepper. And just thin slice those turnips, put them in there for a couple of days, pull them out, pat them dry, and just pile them on a plate. They're just wonderful, just like a little potato chip. So there's the jumping off place for you. And after all that basically healthy eating, the birthday cake should be the most lavish thing that would make you happy.
Yes, that's already in the works.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome, and happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
Bye. Bye. We got a question from Jenny from Wisconsin. She was talking about how expensive ingredients can get, and they're especially when they're the kind of ingredients that you use once or twice, and the only way you can get them is in big containers, and then they go bad, and it's like throwing money away. The example she used was tahini, you know, which is ground sesame paste, and she wanted to know, can I make my own? Well, I have to tell you, it's been a long time since I've done this, but memory serves that I made my own tahini, and it would be a case of buying a flock of sesame seeds. You probably want to get a little oil in there, even though they have their own oil. If you want to add a bit of toasted sesame oil, Asian oil, or just a neutral oil like canola, and hit the blender. And if you want to do half toasted sesame seeds and half untoasted, you'll get that nice toasty flavor. And you could make as much as you want. I'd say it is definitely worth a shot because I've had that tahini sitting around after using a tablespoon and, you know, 3 years later. So give it a shot. And you can call us 800-537-5252 or you can ask us questions on Facebook and Twitter. Noah's on the line from Des Moines. Noah, what's on your mind?
Hey, Lynn. What is on my mind is getting out of a dating rut and the book Like Water for Chocolate by Laura Esquivel.
Oh, yes, yes. But what's the dating rut?
Well, I'm recently moved back to Iowa and kind of just I haven't been able to find the right guy or meet him or, you know, pick him up, basically. And so yeah. It's like I feel like I need something to kind of get me out of the rut.
So you're thinking cooking the kind of dishes that are in Like Water for Chocolate?
Yeah, something cathartic and emotional and sort of heart-opening.
Oh, my, oh, my. What are your favorite flavors?
My
favorite flavor? Because it should be something you love, because if you love it, sharing it with someone else is going to be easy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'd say that my two favorite types of cuisine are kind of authentic Spanish flavors, and then I also lived in Rome for a semester, so I kind of go back to those as well.
Well, you know, obviously Rome strikes a chord with me, but I love Spanish food, and I think you might want to look at, there's a couple of books on Spanish food that are really interesting, and I think one of them is called The New Spanish Table. It's by Anya van Bremsen, and her recipes are quite wonderful. And, you know, things like fruit salads that are done with warm paprika, you know, that wonderful smoky paprika that's been warmed in a bit of olive oil with a little bit of shaved onion. And then you just put that over whatever fruit is in season. It would be oranges in the winter, but they could go over melons at this point. And wonderful little ideas for tapas, like taking little pork short ribs and cooking them with tomato and onion and, again, either paprika, or you could do small, very sweet green peppers. They don't have to be spicy. And you just let them cook in that, and then you can eat them with your fingers and little bites of the fruit, which you can eat with your fingers as well. It's just this lovely, sensual way of eating, you know, with some good bread. So that's one. Anything by Penelope Casas is going to be very authentic. And then I'm trying – oh, Jose Andres. He's the Spanish chef in Washington. He has a TV show. He does gloriously simple recipes. He did a series on Spain, and his food is incredibly delicious. So I would say look for recipes from these people. And that will that's the kind of thing that I think will really – well, to me, that's warm, wonderful, connecting food. Does that are you thinking a bit along those lines? Is that
I want something, you know, while I'm still single that will kind of inspire me. And then once I find the right guy, you know, something to share.
Yeah. And also don't forget seafood because I just had a big dish of clams that were steamed with garlic and chopped up kale and red onion. And it was basically a Spanish recipe. And the onion and the garlic had been cooked in a bit of really good olive oil with the chopped up kale. Not a great deal of it. And then the clams had gone into the pot and had been covered and steamed. Oh, it's just lots of bread and just keep dunking like crazy. And you could do the same thing with mussels.
So, what do you think about quail?
Quail's fabulous.
That's one of the recipes in the book that I recall most vividly.
That would be utterly wonderful. One of the things I love to do with quail, it's a little bit more Italian, but I butterfly it. I take the backbone out and I open it up. And if I can, you know, if I'm feeling fancy, I remove the ribs and whatever. But what I do is I crush together olive oil and garlic and a good amount of fresh thyme.
Ooh.
And lemon. And that gets packed around the quail and it's put in the fridge overnight. And then I take it out, and if I have a grill going, I slow grill it. You know, you don't want to grill it too fast, but you want to keep it a little pink. Or if I'm working on top of the stove, I do a big, big skillet and I just sear it and then I give it maybe 3 or 4 minutes aside.
Okay.
And you serve that with rice or, oh, golly.
Jose Andreas and quail. That's what I'm going to
remember. Jose Andreas and quail. Yeah. You're home free. You're home free.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. You are welcome. Take care, Noah. And good luck.
Thanks. Bye.
Goodbye. It's tough moving to a new city. Even if you're from there, life has changed, and it's really tough connecting with people. I love a man, though, that thinks, I want to comfort myself and kind of connect with my feelings, and then if I find someone, I can share that. Great idea. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Give us a call, 800-537-5252. Jessica Hagee is the author of How to Be Interesting. Producer Jen Russell tracked her down with a very specific request. How to be interesting at a dinner party.
I recently found myself invited to a dinner party. Between work and the kids, it had been one of those really long weeks. And by Friday night at 7, I had nothing left. I arrived at the party exhausted and with a bad case of dinner party performance anxiety. I managed to muddle through, but that got me thinking about what it really takes to be interesting in a situation like that. And I can't be the only one. So I went straight to an expert, the woman who literally wrote the book on how to be interesting.
I think the dinner party itself is a great stage to sort of showcase interesting in a lot of different ways. And you can show up basically as an observer of other interesting people and let that be sort of a learning experience for you, or you can show up and be a little bit more of the life of the party. But the main thing to be interesting is to show up. And the first step is to go exploring, which is probably, if you're out of your comfort zone, if you're wandering into somebody's house for the first time, that's one step in and of itself.
Okay, Jessica doesn't mean rummaging through your host's medicine cabinets, closets, or drawers. She means be adventurous, try different foods, engage strangers in conversation.
Sort of be prepared to have awkward conversations with new strangers, because good conversation is a little bit like, I'll say, coaxing a feral cat out of a drain pipe. You need some bait, you need something to talk about, you need to be perceived as non-threatening, and you have to sort of prepare yourself to be hissed or clawed at, basically because you don't really know who you're dealing with. But that's all okay, because it's just part of the process of getting to know new people. People love to talk about themselves, and if you can start the conversation with a question other than, how do you know the host and what do you do for a living, you'll be able to get a lot more interesting conversation out of whoever it is you're talking to.
Okay, give us an example.
Usually it's, how did you get here? And that sort of brings in, well, I have this old broken down vehicle, or I rode the bus with these crazy people who were doing witchcraft in the back, or something. Really just sort of opens up conversation into I have to think about something other than what I already have canned in my head.
So there are extroverts who can keep an entire room wrapped with their amazing story or joke-telling abilities. And then there are the introverts.
Yes, listening is a key way to not only take in interesting information that you can share later, but to make other people feel interesting themselves. And coaxing people out of that sort of, I don't think it's introversion, but I think it's that sort of shyness or that I'm going to shut myself down and be very quiet motion is, when in doubt, just keep sort of asking them questions.
Jessica, what about that person who's had too much to drink or won't stop talking?
Well, if you can't take their wine away, you should definitely try and take away their soapbox. If you're the host, you can ask them to help you in the kitchen with something and just remove them from the situation or turn the conversation into a topic where they have no expertise and you hope that they won't be able to weasel in and take that over so quickly. But really, the domineering people are sort of obstacles to good conversation with everyone. And once everyone sort of realizes that that character is, for lack of a better term, the bore at the party, everyone sort of becomes in cahoots with derailing him.
Okay, what about that other dinner party killer? Awkward silence.
Yes, if you're faced with an awkward silence at a dinner party, the only thing that I can think that is always gets everyone murmuring and talking again is to give the host a compliment. because they're the person who is feeling the weight of that awkwardness the most. And to just sort of quickly turn around and say, you know what, this souffle is magnificent, and you have to tell me all about it.
Mm-hmm. So being interesting at a dinner party isn't that hard. It really boils down to just a few simple steps.
I'd say there are top three things that you should always have in your pocket when you show up at a dinner party is to be ready to be a good listener, to bring a gift for the hostess or the host, and to offer to clean up at the end of it, because nothing says you're really invested and paying attention like the willingness to help.
Thanks, Jessica.
Thank you.
Jessica Hagee's book is How to Be Interesting. She created some exclusive diagrams for us on how to be interesting at a dinner party. You can find them at, you know where, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. You have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this message from Friedrich Nietzsche, who said, "In heaven, all the interesting people are missing." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, information on almost everything you heard here today can be found at splendidtable.org. Take a look at our latest ebooks, our summertime grilling guide, download our weekly podcast, work your way through our recipe box, and register for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Every Wednesday, we send you a recipe and inspiration for some good weeknight eating. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.